Sports Talk continues with Jimmy Himes. I'm John Wilkerson. And courtesy of our good friends at A.G. Hines Company, providing building materials since anyone can remember, it's time for us to catch up with SEC replay official Gerald Hodges. And Jimmy, he joins us on the Stanley Fencing and Gates Hotline.
Yes, Gerald, how are you doing?
Good, well, Jimmy. John, how are you?
Fantastic.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Appreciate that. All right.
No problem.
I want to run by a couple of things that I saw over the weekend and get your take on this. And sometimes I overlap with the NFL and college, but I think this rule is similar, and I want to get your take on this. So I'm watching a game, and there is a pass that goes up the sideline, and it's out of bounds by 5 or 6 yards, and they call pass interference. I thought the ball had to be catchable for there to be pass interference. Yet this one was not catchable since it was so far out of bounds. What's the general rule on that, Gerald? Help me out with that one.
Sure. The rule states that, if a pass is uncatchable, then you would not have pass interference. There's one little sentence in there that just gives some guidance, but it says, if there is any doubt, the pass is catchable. So there's some wiggle room as far as judgment on that, but that's the way the rule reads exactly, that, you know, if it is truly uncatchable, then there is no pass interference.
Okay. All right. Another one that I saw a couple of times, and it made me wonder a little bit. So I saw a quarterback rolling back out of the pocket, and he was rolling to his left. He's right-handed. Then he flipped the ball forward, and the ball was 10 yards short of the line of scrimmage, and there was no receiver nearby. That's got to be intentional grounding. Would that be the rule?
It would. And there's two things to it, Jimmy. And one of them is to conserve time, or the other one is to conserve yardage. But it's same wording either way. To conserve yardage throws the ball forward into an area where there's no eligible teammate receiver. And it's a loss of down at the spot of the foul for that one. Same thing if it's conserved time. In other words, he's running around, he sees he's not, and he throws it. Anyway, there's no one in the area. And now, also, there's any number of players that could be ineligible. If you have a slot receiver that gets too close up to the line of scrimmage and he's covered up by the wideout, and he is ineligible by position. So he is the same as a lineman that is ineligible by number and position. So, but that is true. If there's no one in the area, then it's a loss of down at the spot of the foul.
Now let me ask you this one, because sometimes I think this can be a difficult call. There are times when I see a quarterback in the pocket and he starts to throw in an area, he gets hit as he's throwing, and the ball kind of wobbles out of his hand. There's nobody near it. It didn't get past the line of scrimmage. Is there leeway for that quarterback who gets hit while he's throwing, because he really wasn't trying to intentionally ground it? He was trying to make a throw, but he got hit. So does that apply to this? Do you have to consider that when applying this rule?
Well, yeah, if he is hit, the way the rule reads, a forward pass is when the passer's arm is coming forward in control, and for whatever reason, if it goes forward, then it's just basically an incomplete pass. You'll see that a lot when he actually has control of it, and the defender will knock the ball out of his hand. If it's in his hand and it's knocked out, and goes forward, it's forward pass. But now if he gets hit, and you've seen this, he gets hit, his hand comes forward empty, the ball, say, just drops straight down or behind him, then that is a fumble. That's the key between the pass fumble that we have to look at in replay.
Okay.
Let's go to the phones. It's Alan who joins us. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Alan.
Hey, guys. It's great to be 1-0.
Boy, it's a good feeling.
It is. So here's my question. In the Auburn game, Auburn running back kind of got stuffed at the line, at the goal line, and then worked his way, as almost his whole body was across. They called it down at the half yard line and they did not reverse it. So my question is there two-way conversation going on with the replay official and those on the field, such that the replay official said, hey, did you call him down by contact or down by forward progress? Where down by contact, they could have reversed it and said, nope, he made it in. But down by forward progress, I believe, is not reviewable. Is that correct?
That is the way the rule reads, yes, sir. If they rule forward progress, then that is not a reviewable play. If they rule down, say a knee down or any body part other than the hand or foot, that is reviewable.
Okay. I don't know if you saw that play. I mean, he obviously got in the end zone. I was just guessing that. I don't know if the announcer said it or not. I wasn't paying close attention, but the only way they could have said that wasn't a touchdown is if the guys on the field said, no, we stopped it for forward progress. I don't know if you saw it, or Jimmy or John.
I saw it. Here was what was interesting to me. Now, this is my opinion. I thought he scored. You might have thought it was more obvious than me, but I thought he scored. Now, the thing that got me was there wasn't a camera shot going directly down the line, Alan. There was one from the end zone, and there was one from kind of behind the plate, an angle. And it wasn't one directly down the sideline. Did you notice that?
I can't remember. I'm with you. I absolutely believe he was in the end zone, no doubt.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that if they blew the whistle and said his forward progress had already been stopped, then they couldn't, you know, they can't judge whistle progress. He obviously was not physically down or whatever. So
yeah,
that's the only way I could justify that they didn't reverse it.
I do not think that they call forward progress. I also don't think that they ruled his knee to be down, because the knee almost hit the ground. You remember seeing how close that was?
Yes.
His knee almost hit the ground. So I don't think they call forward progress, but I think what happened was because, and this is what I understand, right now, a lot of these folks, and we talked with Jerry Punch about this, ESPN, CBS, all these folks are working with skeleton crews. They didn't have somebody with that shot directly down the line to tell you definitively that he scored, which I think makes it hard to reverse the call, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and obviously what an incredible, horrible, and could have been worse turnaround that call was, right? The intersection, the pick six, the you know, they did get the pick six call back, but, you know, it ended up being just a crucial, you know, crucial. You kind of think, well, just sneak it again and you'll get it, right? And
that's what
I can remember a Tennessee Georgia game where we were going in at halftime and fumbled the handoff and the whole game changed. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Georgia ran it back for a touchdown.
Yeah, that's the last time I saw my son cry. Or maybe it's the last time he saw me cry.
Yeah. I vote for number two.
Yeah. Take care, guys.
All right. Okay. Sure do appreciate it, Alan. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Gerald, he had that rule right, though, about the progress thing. It's not reviewable, correct?
That is correct. Forward progress is not reviewable.
Okay.
And also part of his question was just the procedure of it. Is that part of the conversation in terms of when they confer with you, here's what we ruled on the field, and that's the conversation, as well as the folks that joined from Birmingham?
Right. When the referee comes to the headset, actually before he comes to the headset, if we shut down a play to review, regardless of what it is, John, what we have to clearly get is the ruling on the field. And typically, you know, the ruling on the field, then they would say, you know, if we have a knee down, he's short of the goal line, or he's across the goal line, and or we have forward progress. And then, you know, once they rule forward progress, that pretty much takes us out of the equation on most of the plays.
Let's go back to the phones to Jeff, who joins us. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, gentlemen. Mr. Hodges, I do appreciate you taking an hour through the season. I'm going to preface this by saying many years ago, I worked at the Hyatt downtown and got to know some of the reps who were in. And you see the same ones because they do, by the league's ruling, we had Jimmy Harper and Al...
Allison?
Al Ford.
Probably had Al Ford.
Yeah. So the reason I ask this is this year, because we're playing nothing but conference games and you don't have guys spread all over the conference. And I'm going to say it because it's kind of what it is. For an optics standpoint, will there be more crews doing different schools this year?
I'm having a hard time hearing you, but the typical rule of thumb for, it's been that way for over 25 of the 32 years I've been in here. Typically, you will not work a school more than twice in the season, and that's pretty much a standard rule. But I know you think you see a lot of them every week, but after you actually don't. I can't remember in a long time that I had ever worked school more than twice during the season.
Okay. Well, I had always thought that was the rule, but then I would go back to when I was working, and I swear I'd see Jimmy Harper three times a year, if not more. Now, that goes back a while. But to that end, I thought that was the rule. But like I said, there's an optics thing that some people think, well, they do every game they do, and I just wondered – kind of what the rule was.
Yeah, it's not a hard and fast rule because, and especially in today's climate, you might see an official more than twice because you have to be filling in. But I was actually on Jimmy's crew for a while when I first got in, and we never worked the school over twice. But of course, you see him on TV every week. That's the other thing. He had some good ball games. So,
he had a good game. You're right.
Exactly.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Yes,
Jeff,
sir.
Thank you. Let's go next to Ron. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Ron.
Good evening, gentlemen. I always look forward to your segments, Gerald, so I appreciate your time. Kind of a two-part question. two-part question that's kind of leading into a question. Jeremy Banks had two personal foul penalties, and I thought that was a disqualification at the second one, but I could be wrong, which kind of leads me to all the jersey swapping that was happening. I noticed that they were showing on the sideline a lot of jerseys were being changed for special teams plays during the Tennessee game, and I didn't know if that was so you didn't have the same number on the field twice or because you had to line up as an offensive lineman and have a certain jersey number, which leads me to question, how do you keep track of that if, say, a player does have an unsportsmanlike, how do you know that he wasn't an unsportsmanlike if jersey number 33 and then he switches to jersey number 88 and does it again? Wondering how that is all followed.
Okay. The first part of your question is correct. If you get two unsportsmanlike fouls in a game, that is an ejection, and they've also made a distinction this year. Two unsportsmanlike fouls is an ejection. The player has to leave the game, or has to leave the field, and they've made a difference on disqualification and ejection. A disqualification would be a targeting foul. That's a disqualification. This year, they don't have to leave the team area. So that way they're better off staying on their team sideline in that instance. But for an unsportsmanlike or a fighting, that's an ejection, so they would have to leave the playing field. And on your other thing, they had a minor change this year on the jerseys. And what they can do, the And you're right. It could be by position if they need to be an offensive lineman for whatever reason. But they have to notify the referee, and the referee has to notify the opposing coach. And so that way, say number 20 is now number 58, or a lot of times they'll put a lineman in as a back. It might be number 77. He's all of a sudden a fullback or running back, and he might be 32. They have to notify the opposing team coach prior to that play. So, and it's a major 15-yard penalty. So,
okay. Yeah, and it seemed like I didn't really notice it much in previous years up until yesterday with the jersey swaps and so forth. And I don't know, maybe I missed it. I thought the Banks had two personal fouls, but I don't know if I missed that. Distinguish. Maybe one.
Yeah, he had two personal fouls. Distinguish that, Gerald, between personal foul and unsportsmanlike.
He had two personal fouls, and that could be anything, clipping, roughing the passer, but it has to be an ejectable offense, so you get two unsports. Of course, that can be even a non-contact, a taunting or something after the play. If you get two of those, that is an ejection. But just two, what we call run-of-the-mill personal fouls would not be an ejection. Now, what they do on the field, every time there is a unsportsmanlike call, you'll hear the referee get on the headset, and he'll announce to the, or his microphone, he'll announce to the stadium that, you have an unsportsmanlike on number so-and-so. That is his first unsportsmanlike of the game. So everyone on the field writes it down. We write it down in the booth. And so, then we keep track of that also. The other change they can have no more than two players on the field wearing the same number. Up to even last year, they've got to be pretty tough on the on-field guys and even us in the booth. There would be four or five players wearing the same number. Now, some of them would be offense and defense, but where that guy came into play was, if you did have an unsportsmanlike on, the number five who happened to be a wide receiver, and then you had number five who happened to be a linebacker, you had to know for sure which one had the unsportsmanlike. So it took a little paperwork off our backs.
Gotcha. I appreciate all that clarity, as always, so thank you.
Ron, we sure do appreciate you. We've got more with Gerald Hodges to join us, 656-9900, 656-9900, star 990 is free for AT&T and U.S. Cellular customers. The toll-free number, 1-866-656-9900. Gerald's appearance brought to you by A.G. Hines Company, providing building materials since anyone can remember. This is Sports Talk on 99.1, The Sports Animal.
The Sports Animal and Alexa are best friends. Just tell her, Alexa, enable the 99.1 The Sports Animal skill.
Skill enabled.
Then anytime you want immediate Tennessee sports info, say, Alexa, play 99.1 The Sports Animal.
Okay, playing 99.1 The Sports Animal.
Sports Talk continues with Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson. Our guest, SEC replay official Gerald Hodges. Gerald with us for the rest of the program. To get a question or comment in for Gerald, 656-9900, 656-9900. Want to remind you that tonight at 8 o'clock, be sure and tune in for Big Orange Hotline. As, let's see, you'll have Bob Kessling, Jeff Francis, and Pat Ryan break down Tennessee's win at South Carolina, as well as perhaps take a peek ahead to Missouri and the home opener this Saturday at noon. But let's go back to the phones and talk to Odell, who joins us. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Odell.
Hello, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I got couple of probably going to be stupid questions for you guys. When the quarterback clocks the ball, why is that not intentional grounding? There's no receiver anywhere around it. The ball's in the air and the receiver and the defensive back are both going for the ball and it's underthrown, and the receiver can't get to the ball without going through the defender, is that pass interference?
All right. To do your first one, you're talking about spiking the ball to stop the clock?
Yes.
Yes,
okay,
sir.
Okay, that is permitted by rule. That's just an addition they've added. It's been in for a long time. But they can snap the ball and spike it to stop the clock if they're out of timeouts. But now, if the say the clock is stopped and it is, if there's 3 seconds or more, say a guy runs out of bounds and they're trying to get a play and made a first down, but the clock stopped. If there's 3 seconds or more, he can spike the ball one time and then he'll get another play. But if there's 2 seconds or left when he snaps it, they have to run a play. It's going to be the last play. So
yeah, every play takes a minimum of 3 seconds, right?
Right. In other words, if there's 3 seconds or more, then he can spike it and get one more playoff. So they also had a rule change this year about that same thing. If toward the end of either half, if the offense is out of timeout, then they run and make a first down and stay in bounds. Well, the clock's going to stop for them to set and change. So this year, if there's less than 3 seconds, in other words, there's 3 seconds, then they have, and time runs out. Say time runs out, just they don't get the clock stopped. If there's 3 seconds on the clock, then we can put 3 seconds back on. There's less than 3 seconds, say there's 2 seconds, and they're going to put it down and wind it, then the half is over. So that's a new change this year also. So
I was watching a game from 2017 earlier today, and the quarterback underthrew the ball badly, and the defender was going to catch the ball, and the receiver tried to go through him to get to it, and they called pass interference on the defense. I mean, I don't see how that could be pass interference when the quarterback underthrows the ball and the receiver is trying to go through the other guy trying to get to the ball. Don't they both have the same right to the ball?
That is the exact wording. The offensive and defensive player both have a right to the ball. And it's funny, but the way the pass interference rule reads, it's really simple, but it's certainly not as simple to officiate. But what the ruling says on pass interference is that you cannot make an obvious attempt to impede the opponent. So typically, of course, you'd have to see it. I was a downfield official. That was one of my main calls with pass interference, either offense or defense.
Hey, Gerald.
In that
instance, let's say, for instance, the receiver sees that the ball's underthrown. If the defensive back is running step for step with the receiver and does not see the ball, is not making an effort to play the ball, and the receiver turns back and runs essentially through him to try and make the catch, does that change the ruling at all?
That changes it immensely, John. If he's not playing the ball, that is one of the prerequisites for pass interference, is not playing the ball. And you'll see a lot of the TV announcers, and in some cases they're right, but if that defender has his back to the ball, not playing the ball, and then the offensive receiver cannot get back there, that would be pass interference. That's true.
Yeah, I'm a Saints fan, so I'm kind of a stickler on pass interference. Thanks for taking my call.
Tell
me about it.
Jeez.
I bet Jimmy can relate to that one.
Yes.
We sure do appreciate it, Odell. Thank you very much. Let's go next to Doug. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Doug.
Afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon or evening.
Hey, Doug.
Hey, Gerald, I have a story and a question. Talking about pass interference, it has to be a catchable ball. I've told you in the past, Jim Dioplis and I were big friends in Atlanta, and I got to know a lot of the SEC officials. And the year they actually changed the rule about it had to be a catchable ball, Jim was officiating a game with Gooby. You know who Gooby is, don't you?
Who?
Gooby.
That's right. Gooby Snap, yes, I know exactly.
Yeah.
Jim and I watched a lot of ball games together. Yeah.
Yeah. somebody threw a pass. I think it was Tennessee-Alabama game that was about 10 feet over the receiver's head, and Doobie didn't threw a pass interference flag. So in the locker room, they were sitting there, and Jim said, they changed the rule this year. It has to be a catchable ball. And Doobie reached in his pocket and pulled out the rule book and said, no, it doesn't say anything about it here. And Jim said, well, Doobie, that rule book's 5 years old. And Doobie said, I don't give a damn. It's the best one we ever had. But anyway, I saw there was some controversy in the TCU game. TCU scored, I guess, when the clock ran out and they were 3 points behind. And they didn't run the extra point. And I believe my understanding is, isn't it, if it won't affect the final score of the game, they don't do the extra point?
They have that option, yes. They sure do.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, guys. Great show. See you.
Thank you.
Sure do appreciate it, Doug. Thank you very much. 656-9900, 656-9900, star 990 is free for AT&T and U.S. Cellular customers. What we'll do is get a break and be back with a final segment to today's edition of Sports Talk. One more segment with SEC replay official Gerald Hodges. And, of course, what makes his weekly appearance possible, our good friends at A.G. Hines Company, providing building materials since anyone can remember. A final segment to Sports Talk next on 99.1, The Sports Animal.
You know how to pass the time when you're on the job.
With 45 minutes of sports every hour.
99.1.
The Sports Animal.
Final segment to today's edition of Sports Talk. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams. Our guest, hey, Gerald, SEC replay official Gerald Hodges.
Gerald, a couple of things I want to ask you. A late hit out of bounds, is that simply a personal foul?
Typically, Jimmy, unless it is just absolutely egregious. I mean, just, you know, it could be a flagrant person. Now, flagrant personal foul would be an ejection. But if it's right at the sidelines and he gets a little too far out and they hit him, that most of the time it's just a 15-yard penalty.
Okay. What if you jerk the opponent's helmet off and toss the helmet? What is that? Is that unsportsmanlike or just personal foul?
Oh, if they toss it, to me, Jimmy, that would be an unsportsmanlike. Yeah. Sometimes grabbing the helmet, during the tackle, you could possibly, it would be a personal foul, of course, face mask foul. But, I mean, if you jerked it off and then just proceeded to toss it, yeah, that would be definitely an unsportsmanlike.
Okay. So perhaps we had a player at Tennessee that had a personal foul and had two personal fouls, and one of them might have been unsportsmanlike. Okay. I want to ask you this, and I know this comes up a lot, but I'm watching a game, and a receiver leaps up in the air to catch the ball. He has possession first. As he's coming down, the defensive player then reaches in to co-possess the football. So, does it go to the offense because the offensive player had the grasp of it first, or does it go to the defense if the defensive player was the first to touch the ground?
That is a good one. It really is. That happened in a SEC championship games, I think, several years ago. But typically, if you rule joint possession, and our former supervisor, great official Bobby Gaston, always used to tell us this: there's no such thing as joint possession. Somebody's got to have it first. So with that in mind, the way they actually, I think they rule that one, but the way you would probably rule it, if both of them actually had possession, then typically the one that comes down inbounds with the ball first would be, would have possession of it.
Does it matter which one gained possession first or appeared to gain possession first?
No, because remember, Jimmy, you don't have possession until you come to the ground with it.
Okay.
So that's
the key. I should say grasp,
yeah.
Then. Grasp, not possession.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good distinction.
Okay. I want to run one more by you because this has been interesting. you often see a player jump off sides, okay? There's sometimes when I see the officials allow the play to continue, so you have a, quote, free down. Other times they stop it and because they feel like the defender has an unimpeded path to the quarterback. So tell me about that judgment call on the official's part. When, how do they know when to stop it and when to let the play continue?
Okay, that's actually two different fouls, Jimmy. It's the same penalty. But the defense, unimpeded to the quarterback, they will shut that down. And then on your line play, the defense can jump into the neutral zone and get back.
Right.
But if they jump into the neutral zone and cause a reaction by the offense, in other words, make a lineman flinch, then that's going to be on the defense. So, but it has to be heads up with the offensive player. In other words, you can't have a defensive end kind of on the edge jump and then the, you know, the center on offense jump. You know, this guy, he's got to be threatened. They don't consider that a threat. But that's why you'll see sometimes the defense will jump in there and get back. And if they're back before the snap, of course, a lot of times if the quarterback is, you know, on his toes too and he sees that, he'll have to snap the ball. You'll see that occasionally. But then, of course, basically then the other, of course, false start is just, you know, somebody misses the snap count or pulls a hand up on the offense. So then that would shut that down immediately.
So the unimpeded is kind of what I'm getting at. Does the referee have to make a judgment on whether or not they think the right tackle could have blocked him or the running back could have blocked that guy? Does that determine whether it's impeded or not?
No. If he's coming and, you know, there's nobody between him and the quarterback, typically they're going to shut that down.
But if there is somebody between the quarterback and him, they won't.
Right. Well, then you'd have offense. Yeah, you'd have defense offsides. Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gerald, we have just a couple minutes left in the show. It's something when you see a game that just goes back and forth. It seems almost literally like a track meet. And I'm just wondering, how challenging is it when you see something helter-skelter right at the end of regulation like we saw with Texas and Texas Tech, 63-56 the final in overtime? How challenging is that on a crew to keep up with that throughout the course of what can be a really long afternoon or evening?
Well, that John, seriously, is that's the thing that distinguishes, you know, between the really good officials and then the average officials. So you have got to maintain concentration for the full 60 minutes and sometimes overtime and the whole thing. And it's the same way in the replay booth. When you get down toward the end of it, a real tight game, you're going through it with your partner in the booth, you know, okay, we got fourth down, they're out of timeouts. First, and we go through it every play. Okay, it's first and 10 on the 20. They got to go to the 30 for a first down. And we're looking at that because we can get involved on, you know, line to game plays, especially if it's on third and fourth down. So we're looking at all that. We're under 2 minutes. We're talking this back and forth. I'm just kind of giving you our verbiage. Okay, we're under 2 minutes. So anytime the ball goes out of bounds, the clock will start on the snap. We're under 1 minute. Then we get into the 10-second runoff. And all those scenarios. And we remind each other, you know, how many timeouts they have, if any. Mm-hmm. So we are constantly talking back. And the guys on the field are also. They have the O2O, the intercom system. And believe me, they're talking. And that's been a great, great help to it. It keeps everybody on their toes. If one other thing, back in the old days, if every now and then we'd really mess up and let a team call a timeout, and they'd have it. And then back then, there wasn't a penalty for it. So they're reminding each other, okay, offense is out of timeouts, defense is out of timeouts, depending on who's ahead or behind. You can kind of tell the way they're playing. And so those are things that are going through every play, I mean, literally. So it keeps you involved in the game. The concentration at that level of football, and like I said, especially in a tight game, a wild game, the concentration is just, it's unbelievable.
So, wow. I would imagine that's got to be, one, very challenging, but also rewarding at the same time. Hey, Gerald, we sure do appreciate it. Thank you very much. Have a great week. safe travels. Good luck with everything, and we look forward to catching up with you next week.
Great. I'm looking forward to it, guys. Jimmy, have a good weekend.
Jill, appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And that is SEC replay official Gerald Hodges joining us on the Stanley Fencing and Gates Hotline, and his appearance brought to you by A.G. Hines Company, providing building materials since anyone can remember.